Great. Well, anyway, good morning, everybody. Hope this finds you well, coping with everything okay. My talk this morning is titled Right Speech, Talking, Listening, and Singing. So it's been a month since George Floyd was killed by police here in Minneapolis, captured in that horrifying, heartbreaking video. But that video released enormous energy for change. Some change can happen by law.
We can't hear you, Andrea.
Yeah, Andrea, we lost your vocal.
Does somebody email her? Will you email her?
I will, yes.
We need to get her attention.
Everybody wave.
But let me just pick up here where it might have been. A common response to the question of how we can be of help is to be informed and speak up, especially in situations where your silence could signal tacit agreement or permission. Our focus is on anti-racism now, but there are many situations in public and private life where something needs to be said. Being asked to speak up is a reminder that speech is karmic activity. According to the law of causation, whether we choose to speak or not to speak, there will be an effect. Our cultural norms are shaped from within by the things we say to ourselves and to each other in our homes, schools, neighborhoods, workplaces, and civic arenas. But speaking up can be psychologically very difficult, especially in a moment that you didn't anticipate. You suddenly realize that something needs to be said to defend or challenge something that's right in front of your face right now. And speaking up can come with risks, so it's always wise to assess the whole situation wisely. Speaking up was dangerous for me as a child. And now having the ability to speak up well and the courage and resiliency to do it has been a lifelong quest for me. And as a Buddhist, it means finding ways to practice doing it as right speech. I've been thinking about speech a lot lately, because of the Black Lives Matter movement, and also probably because of the extreme quiet of my self-isolation during the COVID pandemic, I've been musing about sound, the way we speak, what is conveyed through the voice, and how speech is more than the words. On the street, during the weekend protests that followed George Floyd's killing, there was a PBS political reporter named Daniel Bush who interviewed the Reverend Frenchie McGee. She's the associate pastor at Hennepin Avenue United Methodist Church. He asked her, "What kind of message do you think the rest of the country has gotten from watching these protests take place in Minneapolis?" Reverend McGee said, "I think what Minneapolis did was start the beginning of a very long, very loud, existential scream. And in the way that carries, it resonated at a frequency with people in other communities who probably felt it in their psyche, and they picked up on that scream, and it became amplified, and it continues to be amplified. We were already screaming. It just wasn't as loud. And now the world, I think, is screaming with us. That's a really powerful image. I think we all feel that scream. When Reverend McGee says the scream resonated at a frequency that others picked up on, that's very interesting to me, because by saying it resonated, she's talking about a vibration. Vibration is in the very nature of life itself, because vibration creates our physical reality. This is true in science and Buddhism. Everything is in constant motion. In Buddhism, we say the universe is vibrating between form and formlessness from moment to moment. Nothing is ever still. But if you align or harmonize your own vibration with the universal vibration, you can experience that movement as stillness. There's a feeling of relief and a realization of what is deeply true. By talking about this existential scream, I think McGee is saying that people around the world are experiencing complete alignment of their hearts and minds around the painful truths of their own lives. And that alignment may be received and experienced as relief, or the experience of something that feels sacred and precious. But my plan for today is to just share with you a variety of the things that have been coming up for me while I've been thinking about speech. So this is not one long, continuous narrative. It's more some episodes. And now I'm moving on to the next one. There's a wonderful video on the internet. You may have all seen it. I actually hope you've all seen it, because it's pretty great. It's of a man holding a tiny fussy baby. He intones to the baby one very long om as a mantra while we watch the baby settle down and appear to fall asleep in less than a minute. Lots of parents have since reported trying this and say that it works. Usually when we think of speech, we think of the verbal content of the message or our style of delivering it. But I think the element of speech that is pure sound should be included in our consideration, because producing and receiving speech is a bodily experience of vibrating air. Zen practice taps into the direct effect of sound vibration through the practice of chanting. The vibration we create in our vocal cords and receive from fellow chanters around us energizes the sensation of aliveness in our bodies, while our breath is like wind moving our inner energy out into the world. Speech is a sound vibration, but when it comes to language, it gets more complicated. Zen teacher Norm Fisher talks about language as a prism. He says that language is so close to us, we cannot understand what it is. We are in language the way a fish is in water. For the fish, water is just the way things are. We're not aware of how language affects us because our consciousness tricks us. According to Buddhist wisdom, there is one total reality in which everything exists in interconnection with everything else. But when that one reality temporarily manifests itself as the world we live in. Our dualistic human consciousness sets us up as separate from everything else. To communicate with each other, we develop language, which then cuts up the original oneness into individual pieces that can be named and discussed. It's a very practical way of dealing with the world we live in, but it's a problem for us when we forget the original oneness. That forgetting is the delusion of ignorance. Fisher says that the Buddha saw how our inner use of language conditions our views, intentions, and actions, and therefore that the starting point for spiritual practice is awareness of this process. It seems to me that Buddha's teaching of the Eightfold Path of Liberation originates directly from that point. Right speech is the third discipline on that path. Right speech is a translation of the Pali Sama Vaka. The Pali word Vaka refers to words or speech. Sama has a sense of being perfected or completed and is commonly translated as right, which sometimes causes us problems in understanding what it means because that word means so many other things to us. Right speech is in the moral, ethical, and precept group of the Eightfold Path. One way to understand right speech is as a mindfulness practice that helps us avoid causing harm both to ourselves and to others, because speech touches both. In the discourse on mindfulness meditation, the Buddha says, and what is samavaka? Refraining from lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and meaningless speech, generally understood to mean gossip or idle talk. Refraining means that by maintaining awareness of how language is operating in our minds and bodies, we have a chance to consider if what we are about to say is true, kind, necessary, and timely, and change course if we need to. Another way to understand right is speech that is whole or complete, so that our words represent both our separate individual existence and also the original source of our existence. Katagiri Roshi explained it as the harmony of the phenomenal world and the source of existence working together in harmony. There is no separation between them. This harmony is represented by the word right. The Zazen we do is a chance to enjoy a respite from the prison of language. There is relief in letting words go and resting our minds in that silent ground that exists before words exist. Then language is not a prison, it's a creative opportunity. Fresh new words can arise from the silence of no words and shape our thoughts differently. Norm Fisher didn't only talk about language as a prison. He also said, all language is singing. In singing, the lyrics are in the realm of speech, but there is also an emotional openness, perhaps revealing a vulnerability and a wholeheartedness of expression. The openness that is given by a singer can be received and experienced in the heart of the receiver as intimacy. If we were to think of language as singing, we might start to listen to people differently. Recently, I've been noticing things related to singing that directly connect me to Buddhism. and I want to share a few of them with you. The YouTube videos of Kanho Yakushiji, he chants the Heart Sutra as a song with lively backup music and video projection, drawing large crowds in concert venues. He's a young Japanese Zen monk who will eventually take over his family's Rinzai temple. But meanwhile, he's been assigned to help connect Zen with people in fresh new ways. On his videos, you often see the crowd chanting along with great enthusiasm and happiness all over their faces, something that you wouldn't see in a Zen temple. So I feel kind of happy that the venerable Heart Sutra has found a modern place on the concert stage. The Dalai Lama has made an 11-track album of his teachings and mantras set to music. It will be released in about 2 weeks on his 85th birthday, July 6th. A preview track entitled Compassion is his chanting of Om Mani Padme Hum with New Age type music in the background. Recalling the recording session, musician Janelle Kunin said, "I had never heard him speak like this. He was really so excited. He actually proceeded to explain to me how important music is. He leaned forward and his eyes were sparkling. And he talked about how music can help people in a way that he can't. It can transcend differences and return us to our true nature and our good-heartedness." I read an article in the New Yorker magazine about Itetsu Nemoto. He's the Japanese monk who counsels people who are considering suicide. He told the writer about his enlightenment experience. He was exhausted from lack of sleep, and he had to carry a heavy pot filled with rice. He stood holding the rice and thought, "I cannot carry this pot any longer. I'm going to die now." Just as he was on the point of collapse, he felt a great rush of energy. He felt as though everything around him were singing and that he could do anything he had to do. And indeed, the person who had been living his life until then was not really him. About that, Katagiri Roshi said, "If you see the world very deeply, then you can hear the sound of the world. The sound of the world is something you are always looking for, but you cannot actually find it through your experience. So finally, that is suffering." In this case, Nemoto did experience that sound as song, which reminds me of the word song in this year, I watched every episode of the NBC TV series, Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. Zoe is a young IT worker who develops a kind of superpower after something goes wrong during an MRI. She becomes aware of people's innermost thoughts by seeing and hearing them singing songs, often with high production values that only she can hear. It starts out seeming like a curse, but the sometimes painful lyrics in the songs that she hears inspire her to respond. She doesn't know what to do, but it starts connecting with people. She starts connecting with people and figuring out how to help them. Every time I watch that show, I think that Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva who hears the cries of the world, now has her own show on network television. Something similar was a few seasons ago on the TV show The Voice, the singing competition. The finalist on that season was Addison Agin. She was my favorite. She didn't win. But she gave a soulful rendition of the song Beneath Your Beautiful. Her coach then was Adam Levine. He said, "There's a comfort I feel when I hear you sing. And I know everyone in the room felt that. There is so much turmoil and craziness in the world right now. But listening to you sing thinks people, listening to you sing makes people feel that all will be okay. Addison can save the world." That is the really power of song. These bodhisattvas bring me to the bodhisattvas' four methods of guidance, or sometimes translated, the four ways bodhisattvas embrace living beings. It's Ahe Dogen's 13th century essay titled Shishobo, and it's part of the Shobo Genzo. The bodhisattvas' four ways are giving, kind or loving speech, beneficial action, and identity action. Katagiri Roshi gave a long commentary on the essay, and it's in his book, Returning to Silence. Here's an excerpt on kind or loving speech. Loving speech is really to give something with your whole body and mind. And if you give something in that way, your whole body and mind really practice loving speech. People can understand and can listen to this sound of your speech. That is why beneficial action is based on two practices, giving and loving speech. The sentence, "People can understand and listen to this sound of your speech," really jumps out at me. Because when we think of speaking up, we hope to talk so people will listen and hear our message. We can learn specific communication techniques, but there's no guarantee that people will receive what we're saying as something worthy of their attention. This says, if we speak from the heart in a sincere, non-gaining way, something trustworthy is transmitted within the tone of our voices and received in an open channel. Kind or loving speech begins with the way we speak to ourselves. Usually we use our harshest voice with ourselves, and that voice becomes the voice we use to talk to others, especially family and people close to us. Practicing kind speech by giving kind speech to ourselves helps us ourselves and is a good way to make speech, kind speech, a habit. You just start by noticing what you say to yourself, then take a friendly attitude towards your thoughts and talk to yourself with a soft voice and tell your story to yourself a different way. Do it out loud. If you can. It sounds a little hokey, but I completely endorse it from my own experience. Here's a reminder of the traditional Buddhist guidelines for practicing the wise and skillful speech of a bodhisattva. There's four. First, not rushing to speak, taking time to breathe before speaking, taking pauses and being in the moment. Making your best effort to speak in a kind, thoughtful, and respectful way, even with someone you don't like. Speak modestly and sincerely in a warm, friendly tone with no hint of judgment. Speak in a spirit of generosity and kinship that is other-focused, hoping your speech may be of benefit, but not expecting a reward, validation, or any particular outcome. Finally, I have a story about listening. Thich Nhat Hanh said, "Deep listening is the foundation of right speech. Our speech is not just our speech. It is communication, something that happens between people." My story is from one of Carolyn Hax's newspaper advice columns. But let me introduce you first, in case you don't know her. She often gives scripts in her columns for no-nonsense ways of standing up to people. For example, here's how she responded to the friend of a man who was engaged to a woman who didn't behave well when he wasn't around. And she was wondering if she should tell her friend about his fiancé's behavior. And Caroline says, "Please respond in the moment to any nastiness you witness from anyone. Say, 'I think it's offensive to ridicule the way people speak,' or 'I'm not comfortable with this,' or 'You know they can hear you, yes?' Deny her the approval your silence tacitly gives and hold up a mirror instead." So considering this as more or less her usual style, a column that ran earlier this month surprised me. In this column, a woman was looking for help with how to respond to her mother's constant criticism to her about how her brother was raising his son, who was her only grandchild, and the nonverbal communication of disapproval that she was showing to her son. Her mother was saying things like, "They are just slaves to that baby. All he has to do is open his mouth and they are right there. He's making it harder for himself by not telling the four-year-old to entertain himself while mommy and daddy work." The daughter had already tried countering her mother with positive statements about her brother's wonderful approach, but her mother wasn't having it. Then the advice seeker adds, "When my mom says they should let him cry or tell him to go away, I think of all the times she did just let me cry or tell me to go away, and how profoundly lonely and unloved I felt as a child." So, what advice would you give to the daughter who's writing the letter? What could be said to influence her mother to see things differently and let up? Well, here's Carolyn's advice. Next time she blathers on about sending the child away, gently ask your mother, "Mom, did your parents do that to you when you were little?" Then, either way, wait for her to answer or continue. "If they did, then I'm so sorry. It breaks my heart." Then, regardless of how your mother responds, by doubling down, by softening, by ripping into you, or with silence, stake out your belief. Say, "I love how much love they show that baby. I hope every baby on earth gets that kind of attention." Caroline says, "Don't talk about your own loneliness as a child, and don't expect her to invite a genuine effort to connect. Wrap up with a show of support. 'You raised my brother to be a good dad who married a good mom take a victory lap. Caroline's display of radical empathy took my breath away when I read it. This is the kind of listening when you feel the depth of what's going on in another being, because you feel the essence of it deep in your own self. Then your words come from a place of deep connection. The speech that emerges from that depth feels to me very right. This is really the work of our bodhisattvas, people who can hear the scream and speak to it kindly and lovingly. She hopes her words will make a difference and help, but she knows they might not. What matters to her is that she responds. I want to end by suggesting that in many ways, speaking up is an art. My art teacher says that even without putting brush to paper, when we think about painting and look carefully at painting models, we are already practicing our art. We can do this with the art of speaking up too. We can practice thinking carefully about how to do it and keep it in mind as steps in the practice. So thanks for practicing that with me today. And bows.
Thank you, Andrea. We might have time.